This is the Future of HR podcast, episode 112.
One of the things that really stood out that made this work important is that the nature of teams and teamwork has shifted so dramatically from when the conventional ideas, models, frameworks, research was done on how do you form a team, what the optimal sizes are, the development processes, things like that. They really haven't changed a tremendous amount for many, many years since, say, Wisdom of Teams. But if you look back then, generally speaking, teams were, you know, smaller, 6 to 8. They were generally all together in the same space. They were generally on one team and not many team. People were generally not virtual in aggregate. And all that's changed. We looked across the survey results we did. We found that people were not on one team. They were assigned to typically 2 to 3 formal efforts and usually 2 to 3 others that they were a part of that they got placed on to help solve a problem somewhere. So that makes the whole idea of vision, mission, purpose very difficult right out of the fact that people's attention is so scattered. It makes calendaring to be able to just get things done. The teams themselves have grown a lot larger. I averaged about 45% of them were over 11 in size, 18% over about 20 in size. People were coming in and out of the teams more rapidly. 84% of the interactions were virtual or hybrid in nature. And so it's not that the old ideas around teams don't work or need another iteration on how to develop a new process model, but it's the nature of work has changed so dramatically.
How can teams overcome collaboration overload? Why are the 3 components of trust critical to building an effective team? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. If you are a fan of the Future of HR podcast, then you know that I'm a big fan of Deeper Signals. Deeper Signals is a modern scientific assessments platform that is revolutionizing the way organizations measure, manage, and develop their talent. And in the age of AI, soft skills are becoming more and more crucial. And that's why their latest innovation to the Deeper Signals platform, Skills Selector, is a game changer that we've all been waiting for in soft skills-based hiring. Here's why I'm impressed with Skills Selector. 1, it's lightning fast. You get to assess a candidate's soft skills in just 10 minutes. It's fully customizable. You can create customized job profiles that perfectly match your company's needs and your competency frameworks. It's visually intuitive. You can compare candidates side by side instantly. And it doesn't just stop at hiring. It seamlessly transitions into personalized onboarding and development plans so your new hires can hit the ground running from day one. And the best part, it's all backed by science and cutting-edge data analytics. But don't take my word for it. Go to deepersignals.com/futurepod. That's deepersignals.com/futurepod. And try their core drivers assessment for free. It'll give you a sneak peek of the insights you'll gain with the skill selector. And they're going to give you a 14-day free trial to the entire Deeper Signals platform. Don't miss this chance to transform your hiring process. Go to deepersignals.com/futurepod today and see how Skill Selector can make your hiring smarter, faster, and more effective. Since I've doubled down on my mission to develop the next generation of HR leaders, I've been asked to be a keynote speaker for 7 different internal HR conferences or career weeks of Fortune 500 companies. This has been a big honor and a blast. What am I speaking on? Well, I'm leveraging my 100-plus interviews on the podcast and my 20-plus year career as a talent and HR executive to talk about 3 things. 1, how HR leaders can have more influence and impact in what I call the influence equation. 2, how to future-proof your HR career in the age of AI. And 3, the future trends impacting our field. I love speaking to HR teams and I'm extremely grateful for the opportunities that I've had to date. If you're looking for a speaker for your 2025 HR conferences, career weeks, or other meetings, I'd love to hear from you and talk. And with that, I want to introduce this week's guests, Rob Cross and Catherine Brecken from the Institute for Corporate Productivity or better known as I4CP. Rob has studied the underlying effects of effective organizations and collaborative practices of high performers for more than 20 years. Rob's research and writing, speaking and consulting and courses all have a central theme: research-backed advice to help to create a vibrant, effective networks at all levels of organization and at any career stage. Currently, Rob is the Senior Vice President of Research for I4CP and the Edward A. Madden Professor of Global Leadership at Babson College. Rob is also the co-founder and research director of Connected Commons. Joining Rob today is Catherine. Catherine is a senior research analyst at I4CP, where she leads global studies to examine talent and workforce development strategies and practices that impact market performance and human capital outcomes. Most recently, her research projects are involved in team effectiveness, AI, organizational culture. Today, Rob and Catherine are joining us to talk about their latest research project called the Team Network Effect. And I can tell you there's some very interesting, insightful, and new insights in their research. And during my conversation with Rob and Catherine, we discussed why 8 out of 10 teams actually underperform due to collaborative dysfunctions, how common collaborative dysfunctions such as misalignment and priority overload hinder team performance and what to do about it, how companies like Roche and Supercell are using innovative practices to dramatically improve team collaboration, how HR can play a pivotal role in supporting effective team collaboration across an organization, and why combining precision collaboration in a high trust environment is critical to increasing team effectiveness, and much, much more. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode. As you listen, drop me a line on LinkedIn and say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Rob and Catherine. Rob, Catherine, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you both doing?
Doing great. Thank you so much for having us here.
Doing wonderful, JP. Nice to be here. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you on the podcast. I know you're part of the I4CP family, which I'm a huge fan of I4CP. And you got some really interesting research around what you call the team and network effect. Interesting research. So I was really excited to talk about the research today. And I wonder, Rob, if you could start us off and talk about the team network effect. Tell us more about what led to this research project and what you guys were hoping to learn from it.
I have to imagine your audience is wondering exactly what we're going to pull out from one more study on teams, right? It's the second only to leadership to the most studied phenomenon out there. But what we were hearing in different ways is just the degree to which teamwork and collaboration was creating a struggle for a lot of people in an organization. And it became very interesting to us to look at that and see that more as a product of how teams were collaborating inside and outside in very targeted ways, and how looking at that, not as a team, as a kind of holder container of people, but really looking at the interactions inside and outside the teams that were producing the results, if that would yield significant outcome for leaders to be able to think about teams differently. And as we went through it and conducted the broad survey together, over 1,400 organizations participated in this. One of the things that really stood out that made this work important is that the nature of teams and teamwork has shifted so dramatically from when the conventional ideas, models, frameworks, research was done on how do you form a team, what the optimal sizes are, the development processes, things like that. They really haven't changed a tremendous amount for many, many years since, say, wisdom of teams. But if you look back then, generally speaking, teams were, you know, smaller, 6 to 8. They were generally all together in the same space. They were generally on one team and not many teams. People were generally not virtual in aggregate. And all that's changed. We looked across the survey results we did. We found that people were not on one team. They were assigned to typically 2 to 3 formal efforts and usually 2 to 3 others that they were a part of, that they got placed on to help solve a problem somewhere. So that makes the whole idea of vision, mission, purpose very difficult right out of the fact that people's attention is so scattered. It makes calendaring to be able to just get things done. The teams themselves have grown a lot larger. I averaged about 45% of them were over 11 in size, 18% over about 20 in size. People were coming in and out of the teams more rapidly. 84% of the interactions were virtual or hybrid in nature. And so it's not that the old ideas around teams don't work or need another iteration on how to develop a new process model, but it's the nature of work has changed so dramatically that being able to look at teaming as a product of how these interactions form inside and outside these groups and be precise on what's creating high performance and help leaders do that is actually quite needed today. If you look at how many people are just burning out and exhausted a lot of it has to do with how much teaming and how much collaboration is being put on people without a true sense of the cost and the impact of the collaborations that are happening out there. So that was what led us into the work, was a pressing need at that level. And then I would say beyond that, one of the things that became very clear to us throughout the work is, I'll state the obvious here, right? Teams are the primary way anything of substance gets done in organizations. But HR as a discipline doesn't tend to support and manage teams. They tend to support and manage individuals, right? With the talent practices, the performance review processes, things like that, led us to another really interesting insight to say, there are shifts that need to be made in how we think about HR mechanisms supporting performance today that help move us more to where it's actually getting created. It's not an individual phenomenon much anymore. It's much more a team level phenomenon. So those were some of the ideas that kind of led us into this work as we went.
Wow. Well, I think you whet our appetite here to talk more about teams. And as you're talking, Rob, I was sitting there thinking, well, no wonder we can't get stuff done because we're all in like five teams and can't find time to collaborate versus getting some of that real work done. Catherine, as you say, in the research, the 21st century teams are like a goldmine of untapped productivity. Well, I think it does feel true to us. Tell us more about why you believe this is true and what you learned from that research.
It's because of data, first and foremost. As Rob mentioned, we surveyed 1,400 organizations across the globe. And we asked participants to think about a team they were on currently and then estimate the degree of performance improvement that could occur if they collaborated more effectively. And then they picked a number, essentially. That is now in a number of presentations as a poll question, most recently to 120 plus executives in Singapore. And the curve is always the same. Almost no one thinks they've got collaboration now. Maybe one or two people in a crowd are like in 0%. And then there's a smattering, maybe 5-9% that are saying, I could improve collaboration now, maybe like under 10%. And then the bulk are between 11% and 50% every time. It's a very, like I said, normal curve. But the reason we think that is occurring, we hear in our interviews as well, it's just what Rob said. Teams are way different today than they were even just 5 years ago. And the norm that by which we tried to create successful and increase performance in teams don't necessarily apply as well as they did once. And because we manage to one, we tend to manage to the individual in the org. Most of our incentives and so forth are at the individual level. Our performance management is done through a one-on-one. So we drive impact by the individual, not necessarily the team, but people haven't really been thinking about that. So on average, we found that the average team could increase their performance by 39% if they improved collaboration. And even the most effective teams, on average, they could increase their productivity by 30% if they improve collaboration. So basically, like, everybody's got something to gain from figuring this out.
Yeah, well, I'm so excited to dive in more because I think this is so needed in our organizations. And I love that you're also focusing on how we think about the team and managing teams and team performance, because I think it's a real gap, not only from a reward system, because a lot of times we always talk about how individual performance, but how do you reward that team? Because as you said, we are dependent on those teams to get work done. A lot of these teams, you said, aren't that really that functional. They're not maybe sometimes dysfunctional. They're not that productive or on multiple teams. And Rob, in your research, you found that 8 in 10 teams actually underperform due to what you call collaborative dysfunctions. So talk a little more about some of these common collaborative dysfunctions that are holding us back.
One of the strengths, I think, of being able to look at these dysfunctions is that it removes it from being a situation of saying, oh, the leader's failing. Almost anytime something goes wrong in a team, that's the first place people look, and then they start blaming each other in general. And I think one of the strengths of these dysfunctions is saying, you know what, we just haven't been paying attention to how we're collaborating inside and outside, and we're drifting into this because it's a natural knee-jerk reaction that we have to just collaborate more, right? And we're overwhelming people. That's one of the dysfunctions as an example. As we looked at it, what we were doing initially was using organizational network analysis across a lot of places to then see, number one, what predicts high-performing teams, and we'll come back to that in a little bit. But number two, we could pivot that coin around and start to see, well, when underperformance happens, right? Not necessarily bad, that they just don't deliver on time, whatever it may be. And there were really consistent patterns. We see a series of 6 of these that were very pronounced. And what's been really affirming for us is when we put these up in front of people on a single slide, universally people say, oh my gosh, I saw 2 of those last week. know, or they see it kind of immediately in their teams. It just gives a different lens to see how it's going on. Two of them I'll grab just for the audience here. One that we saw that had the greatest impact on team effectiveness and that concurrently had an impact on market performance was misalign. That's when people come into a group and they kind of agree or think they've agreed, and then they're going off and pulling in slightly different directions. And that's very prominent in cross-functional work. I can say from the hundreds of interviews I did, really successful leaders driving enterprise results, it was the archetype that they most regretted in their careers. If misalignment happened and wasn't addressed early, it tended to just spin things up and create enormous amounts of time. Now, what's important about it to us, though, and what we spend a good bit of time on, is misalignment can get created from a lot of different angles. Sometimes the teams would say, we're misaligned because we don't trust each other and we're not kind of going along with what other people say. Sometimes they'd say we're misaligned because the leader isn't putting enough structure into the work and we don't have expectations really of what I should be doing, let alone what somebody else should be doing. And we're frustrated each other in terms of how we're coming back. And sometimes misalignment occurred completely outside the team, right? It would be functional leaders or stakeholders telling those team members how they should be leaning and what they should be doing and spending time on. So the drivers of each of these dysfunctions was an important piece of this work because it allows leaders to then go back, look at their teams and ask their team, here's six of these. Are we drifting into one or more? And do we want to do something about it? And then get more precise on what's actually happened that's creating. Because it's a very different thing if you don't trust each other, the misalignment's occurring outside, right? And driving in. You just take different action. We found that one, misalignment, was the most impactful on team effectiveness. We found the most prominent archetype was what we call priority overload, where there are too many disconnected asks coming into the teams. And a lot of times the leaders don't have either the skills or the comfort to reprioritize in the moment, right? So they end up just taking things in and they burn the team out. Performance starts to suffer. Engagement starts to suffer. It's really a byproduct of all we've done to create kind of one firm cultures, agile ways of working, things like that. There's a lot of positives, but one of the negatives is we've seen that archetype really rise up. And again, we can equip team leaders with the ability to say, okay, here's what's happening, right? Here's ways to think about it. Here's ways to solve it and have pretty pronounced effect pretty quickly.
Interesting, when you look at those dysfunctions by geographic region, it varies. So Rob just mentioned that priority overload is by far and away the most common dysfunction that teams suffer from when we looked at the aggregate data, absolutely. But when I look at just like the APAC region, for instance, it's hub and spoke. When you have a leader or a subject matter expert that is heavily dependent upon to get the work done and bottlenecked occur, right? It really speaks to a very collectivist culture where a lot of respect for authority, hierarchical structures. It makes sense that that would be the top function of teams in APAC, but in Europe, it was different. It was overwhelmed. Culture has a lot to do with how we fall into these traps.
Hey, everyone. After a quick break, we'll be right back to our conversation with Rob and Catherine. I'm excited to let you know that I've recently put together a succession planning playbook that you can download for free at futureofhr.com. And whether you want to assess your current approach to succession planning or you're building your leadership development strategy from scratch, this playbook offers an actionable framework designed to help you understand what great succession planning looks like. So go to futureofhr.com and download the succession planning playbook today. Also, one of the key findings from the team network effect was something you call precision collaboration practices that actually increase team effectiveness. Precision collaboration practices. Let's talk more about what that is. It sounds fancy, and we're interested in how we fix some of this overload that Rob talked about.
We felt that HR actually could use some more jargon. We kept hearing that, you know, leaders need to be intentional about how they build collaboration within the team and then the team network across the enterprise. And that word precise kept coming up regularly. And what we call it precision collaboration, right? And everybody thought, yeah, that's a great idea. People totally remember that. Intentional behaviors that create high quality connections generate the market performance of the organization. They're behaviors that improve team effectiveness and ultimately the organization's bottom line. We looked at team effectiveness. We had an index of questions based on extensive research on teams been done over the decade. And what we found with a team's effectiveness, when we used regression to understand its impact on organizations' market performance, we saw very little impact and kind of thoughts about it, actually. But then you add those collaborative behaviors in, what collaborative behaviors those participants said were in place within their team, and the effect of team effectiveness on market performance doubled. What's crazy about that is then we added it in, like, all the questions about trust. So put that in a high trust environment, you know, good collaborative practices in a high trust environment, and the effect on team's effectiveness on market performance ripples. And what we heard when we had open response questions, what would improve your team's effectiveness, that we could hear from people directly. And then we had, Rob's done over 200 interviews with executives, but we've also done some additional case studies. And what I hear out there is my team is high performing team. We get work done. We get it done on deadline. We do not have good collaborative practice. Someone is brown noser, or like there's a toxic personality, or you're getting overloaded, as Rob described. They've got one of those dysfunctions. And so basically they can't sustain the performance. There is going to be burnout, or people are going to leave. You can have high performing teams, but if you don't have strong collaborative practices in place, it ain't going to last. And you can't have that impact, that really strong impact on the organization's market performance.
Let's double click a little bit more and talk about some of those practices that really kind of end up being precision collaboration, because I think it makes sense. And honestly, when I think about sometimes the companies that get written up in Fast Company or Fortune or whatever, they're doing a great job. They're typically startup companies. They're eliminating meetings. They're using Loom and other techniques to collaborate. And they're not having meetings for meeting's sake. That's what we're saying is the heroes of this anti-collaboration or collaborate better culture. But what did you guys find? What does this really look like when we dig into precision collaboration for a leader?
Yeah, so there are categories of collaboration that we see in the model that Catherine was describing. A set of categories and behaviors had to do with how that team is connecting internally. So for example, do they integrate new talent rapidly into the connections that person needs to do their work on that team? Not a lot of places do that well, right? It's actually left up to the team leader a lot. A lot of organizations have onboarding processes, COEs, ERGs, formal mentoring relationships, all sorts of things that form relationships right and left in the organization, but actually very few are working in a way that position people into the network they need to do the work on that team, right, specifically. So there were a set of these things that were structural like that. You know, are we getting rapid engagement? Are we avoiding overloading the center? Are we crossing silos that have impact for us? It was the pattern of connectivity that all came down to behaviors, things the leader and the team was doing. Then there was a second category that had to do with the quality of the connections. Do we trust each other? Do we get a sense of purpose and energy from interacting? Or on the negative, do we create stress for each other unnecessarily? And what we saw there is the negative implications oftentimes outweigh the positives in many instances. And you can't just add more positives to get rid of a negative. You actually have to address both separately as kind of discrete things there. And then the last set of categories had to do with how that group was connecting externally. So the more successful leaders, they tend to shape the nature of the work coming into the teams better. They would much more likely find resources by reaching out to other leaders and saying, how can we pool what we each have to do more for both of our team? There's a set of things like that that gave that team benefits of scale, benefits of being part of a larger organization that other teams didn't necessarily do.
Yeah, Rob, can you give us an example of that? That'd be really helpful.
Yeah, we did some really neat case studies, and that's a huge privilege to have the membership that I4CP has that's so productive in helping to generate these ideas. But one we did was looking at Oliver Wyman, strategic consulting firm. And in that case, we were using network analysis, but we don't want this to be an idea that people are saying you have to go out and do organizational network analysis and map who's interacting with whom in these groups. It's just one vehicle we use to be able to see this effect. But the interesting thing there is we ran the analytics across the broader organization, and then we were focused on what do the networks of the more successful practices and teams look like in that context? And then what's the value of trying to raise the bottom performing teams? So in that specific context, when we just looked at what if we raise that bottom quartile to just average, I'm trying to make superstars, but just average, it was a 54% impact on the profitability metric they looked at. That's a projected 54% impact. So it's not a small number. In any case we're dealing with, when we ask that question of, are we managing performance that way at the team level, not the individual? And what happens if we raise the bottom quartile? It's pretty substantial. Or if we look at what happens if we speed the team's delivery by helping them collaborate more efficiently, the economics are really substantial behind this. That's not small numbers. And what's really cool about that is usually when you compare the bottom quartile to the top quartile, it, honest to God, is not a human capital difference. I mean, you're definitely going to have some people that are smarter, more motivated, working a little bit harder, but that's not a huge explainer, right, of the variant. At the heart of it, you can see that the bigger explainer is how those groups are collaborating. And so in this context, very kind of simple things that leaders could take action on, we found were differentiated. So the top quartile groups, they were much better at getting those people integrated into the network more rapidly. Bottom quartile didn't do it quite as much. Top quartile, they were very good at distributing the work in the team. So overload points didn't happen around leaders and experts. Bottom quartile didn't do that so well. Top quartile, they had very effective and rich external connections back into the context. As a product of that, they're better able to deliver unique results, unique solutions. Bottom quartile didn't do that right as much. Top quartile, they were much more likely to create work contexts where the interactions people were having were executing on the work, but also energized, creating enthusiasm right in the moment. And I've studied that for 26 years. It sounds a little bit froofy at first. That idea of energy and being somebody that creates it, right? Not somebody that is energized, but somebody that creates it or teams that create it. Huge and consistent predictor of high performance across hundreds of organizations. And in this case, what we're basically seeing is the top quartile managed to do both work and energize each other in the way they were doing the work. Bottom quartile, not so much, just kind of getting the work done. All these things, we know a tremendous amount about how you can influence and actually kind of shape the way work's getting done to get the newcomers included more rapidly, to delayer the overwhelmed, to interact in a way that's creating energy and purpose. So that to us is one of the most positive messages here is it's not saying we need a new approach to AI, we don't need a new ERP system, whatever it may be. It's just that we need to look at how work is happening in these teams a little bit differently and equip our leaders to understand different ways of collaborating. It matters today. It'll matter, I bet, even more as we go further into the future of work models that people are projecting.
Yeah, what I love about what you both have found here is that I think a lot of people say, well, the team network effect, are you going to give me new techniques to have better agendas, better meetings, tools to collaborate better? What you're really saying is that there are some other fundamentals like trust, how you bring new hires or new team members on and get them integrated, how you give energy. These are really, really higher order, I think, team leadership skills we have to have. And trust being one that I think we all said, oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But you guys said that trust is actually the secret ingredient to unlocking the team network effect. What did your research uncover around what builds or damages trust in organizations on teams?
That's a great question. So Catherine mentioned already that we found in the context of trust, the predictive abilities of the models we had and the impact on team effectiveness, market performance, was very significant, right? A substantial number out there. What we did that was interesting in this case is we didn't just look at trust as one kind of universal concept. So most people hear the word trust and they think of what I would refer to as personal trust or benevolence-based trust. You know, trust that you're not going to try to take advantage of me per se, or that I can speak my mind, right, without fear of reprisals. And we, of course, looked at that, but there are other very common in the scientific literature aspects of trust around competence-based trust, trust that this person knows enough of what they're doing to influence what I'm up to, or what we can call dependability-based trust. So the term often is integrity, right? And you trust that leaders kind of walk the talk that they're engaged in. We weren't hearing it at that level. We were more hearing, can I trust my team members to come through on what they said they were going to do? So I'll call that more dependability. And we measured each of those in there to see, do those discrete kinds of trust have a positive impact on team effectiveness? And it turned out that all three did statistically. But what was fascinating to us is most people, and we polled on this recently a couple of times, we would say, which of these three forms of trust do you think matter the most? And roughly 76-80% of the people grab benevolence-based trust. And that's akin to psychological safety, which has gotten to be a huge thing in various circles around things we have to cultivate. And it absolutely is, right? It absolutely matters. But a lot of times we get so enamored with a concept that we lose sight of other concepts. And that's a little bit of what's happening here, because as we looked at it, we found that benevolence-based trust or psychological safety mattered, but it was the third most important. It actually turned out that dependability was the most important, then competence, then psychological safety. So if you're in your audience and ask, why does that matter? It matters because you build that fundamentally different. If you're trying to build dependability-based trust, then you need to be thinking about, how do I put structure into the work so people know what the expectations are? How do I start to build norms of accountability so that people are showing up and they don't drift in different ways? That's an entirely different thing than trying to build psychological safety or benevolence-based trust. In those cases, you do things that get people off task. You just do things very differently, really, for each of these three components of trust. And at the heart of what we've tried to do is really help leaders get down and say, not how do I do just one thing? That's the typical approach, is just tell me that one thing that's the most predictive and everybody should go do, because that won't work for not everybody has that issue in there. In fact, for 80% often don't have the issue that that one thing approach solves. But rather to help leaders get down to what are the three or four things that I need to do that can have the greatest impact on my team. So it's a very manageable set of activities we're actually asking. And for some leaders, it would be a focus, benevolence-based trust. For others, it would be competence or dependability. How do I kind of curate that in the groups that I care about? So that was exciting for us, right? To be able to, again, be more precise in what we're going after in terms of this precision collaboration idea, and then very actionable in the things that kind of stimulate that interaction.
Yeah, it's also really helpful to understand how trust is built, how that can vary by team or what that need is. But it does make sense to me that dependability and competence related trust would be the first, because you are now in our world of work, we are relying on other team members to get the job done. So we look good and so we deliver our priorities and they deliver their priorities. And so we have much more interdependency than maybe you had, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago.
To that point, if I just can build on for a second, that's not how we start in most teams, right? We don't start in most teams saying, let me understand the capabilities you're bringing. And they're very tactical things you can do. You give evidence of what you've done. You don't say, I can go do this, right? There's things that you can coach people to do that builds trust in that person's competence. Not that they're not competent, that most people don't give enough information for other people to trust in that. That's the trick that happens. But most times when we form teams, when you say dependability and competence matters, and it makes sense, intuitively, we know that the first thing most people do when they form teams is go have an offsite and say, let's get to know each other. Let's do basically the thing that's building benevolence-based trust and not allow that on the other two, unless they're a little bit more intentional.
You know what's funny about all of this, and I was thinking about your earlier comment, JP, is that the agendas are really important to accomplishing dependability based trust. I mean, if that's how you as a team have agreed upon working, right? It's one of those things that can help provide a little structure so we can all be accountable and a little more reliable, right?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that full circle. Because of course, to be an effective team, you have to think about how you manage the work that plan, have people deliver deadlines and all those good things. And it's not just have a meeting for a meeting's sake. But what I love about what you guys are bringing back is there's some higher order stuff that maybe we need to be thinking about more from an HR perspective. And it sounds like some organizations are thinking this way, Catherine. And the study mentioned a couple of innovative practices from companies like Supercell and Roche. And I'm wondering if you could talk about one or two companies' approach that just stood out for you that was particularly effective or innovative that people could learn from.
Supercell is a fantastic example because it is really a team-based organization. They are a mobile gaming making company and based in Finland, but they're global. They're most famous for the game Clash of the Clans, with some of your fans, JP, may be playing right now. Huge game. The company basically created a team lab for their gaming team. So each team is responsible for a game. They make all the decisions. The company will decide who's on the team. And then you live with that team, basically. As you're responsible for the game. You make all the decisions. You can actually vote people off the island, off your team. You know, you have to make hard decisions and you're trusted to do this. So they have a ton of autonomy. But the team lab that they created, it includes psychologists and stress tests. Really, it assesses the group's ability to collaborate. They're really thinking about collaboration and they will be on measuring the success of their team by the popularity of the game they build and maintain, and to more holistic measurement that help them assess things like well-being and engagement and address collaboration. Roche is also really cool. It's another great example too. Roche, the pharmaceutical company, they provided transparency into what teams are working on. They used a digital platform where the whole company could see what teams were doing and who was on the team. And so providing that transparency, we heard that actually at a number of companies that are doing teaming well, it allows basically several things. So if the whole company can see all the teams and what they're working on and who's on it, senior executives can help supplant additional or provide additional resources, maybe funding or people that could contribute to that team's purpose. But it also creates clarity of roles, goals, and purpose within the team because everybody can see what each other is doing and it allows for bridging. So in the case of Roche, they really were able to create geographical collaboration. So they were having trouble with projects being really largely siloed in certain countries, but they were able to get people from the 89 countries they operate in to work together to solve similar challenges. And they were able to do this because they had transparency. So people in different countries could see like, oh, they're working on the same challenge I want to address. And hey, let's get involved and let's share knowledge. And that's the other thing it allows to do, is really allows what the team is working on to scale across the organization, learning to scale faster.
Yeah, those are two incredible examples of companies doing really innovative work for sure. And my mind went to immediately, well, how do you set those systems up, right? Because that sounds amazing, but what you really have to understand is someone architected that. They really thought about how do we set this up so that it works, so it's not organized chaos and everyone see the teams, how do you do it the right way? And so it seems like HR's got a really important role here. And I wonder if, Catherine, talk a little more about how HR can help teams strengthen their network and improve performance. How do you think you could do that better than we're doing that today, maybe?
I would say HR has a pivotal role to play. The first is this sort of, you have to find the sweet spot between providing teams with total autonomy and some structure. So HR can be a really great place to provide the tool for leaders to do that. Not only the leadership development and training to lead these today's teams that are, as we mentioned, larger and more distributed than ever before. The leadership development is critical, but we also found in companies that were doing this very well, they had compensation or other reward program that really highlighted the team achievement part. So maybe a part of one individual compensation be based on achieving a team's goal, or it may be like there's a financial award that comes out once a year that really is given to an incredible win for a team that occurred. So there's different ways to structure sort of, but the financial incentive is then there to influence individuals to collaborate and join teams and work on teams. And then the other way that that is also influenced and driven through HR is through performance management. And I mentioned at the top of the hour that performance management is largely one-on-one, right? We think about the manager and the employee relationship in there. That can drive collaboration as well. I4CP has a fantastic tool that Rob's brilliant led to that can help leaders really structure these one-on-ones so that they're more engaging and energizing and influencing collaboration. But it comes down to the fact that when you have those conversations, you want to talk about how are you contributing to your team. Microsoft is a great example. They have what's called the Connect process, their rating list performance management process. And really, during those one-on-one conversations, which they're required to have at least 2 times a year, the employee has to talk, yes, about individual accomplishments, but also about how they're leveraging others' achievements and contributing to the collective good. If you're not part of other teams, if you're not contributing, you don't have a lot to say in those conversations. It's really important in how that drives you to really think about day-to-day, how am I supporting my team? How am I getting involved?
That's great. And to put a little bit of a bow on it, if you're an HR leader who's looking to put some of these findings into action, where would you start? What's that low-hanging fruit or the place to get the most momentum?
That's a great question. So what we see, generally speaking, we've asked a lot of the 4CP members in different forums, what are the different avenues that you tend to see to have the greatest effect with this? And one route tends to be through leadership development initiatives that start to teach leaders how to manage their teams and units differently. So when we're saying teams, people made knee-jerk reaction to like a 6 to 8 person team, but these groups could be 20, 40, 60, 200, and oftentimes were, right? They were so large, there's no possible way they could be a team, but people were still throwing kind of conventional team ideas to them. There are approaches that people are taking to say, through our leadership development programs or through things we're offering our leaders, like these toolkits and workbooks, how do we help them start to see the work of those teams differently? And how do we help them see the very specific things they can interject on that can have the biggest impact for the teams themselves? And so that really entails things ranging from programmatic efforts to some of the things that we're building for I4CP members are enabling the leaders, again, to kind of diagnose their team. We do it in a really precise way because we know if the leaders pick by themselves, they're not very good at it. They kind of pick what their issues are and not the team's issues. So we find, though, if we get this kind of approach in, and we have the leader saying, okay, this is the thing that's most important, but then they have to go talk to somebody that's been around a long time, somebody that's new and somebody that's virtual, right? And get them to rate as well, that triangulation quickly gets down to the 3 or 4 things that are going to have the greatest impact for them. So there's different modalities to deliver those ideas. It can be formal leadership programs. It can be manager in a box programs. It can be kind of purely, you know, virtual based things that I think we'll see have pretty significant effort. I think the other way as things evolve is going to be through more internal consultants or HR business line leaders playing a role in this. So we've been experimenting, for example, a case we're writing right now for a hospital system that I can't mention the name of yet. What we did is ran this diagnostic approach, and there were in this group 13 specific teams that needed to be working together. And for that overall group to really perform, those teams needed to be cross-collaborating, not all 13 with all 13. That would kill everybody, but in really targeted ways. So it's a process of working in three different touch points with the team that help them isolate out what are some very targeted things we're going to do as a team, what are some very targeted things I'm going to do as an individual, and then where are these value-added intersection points that if we curate are going to enable us to deliver what we should be doing. So I think that'll be the second route that we see a lot of uptake on these ideas, just given the efficiency of it and the impact overall.
Great. Rob, Catherine, last question for you. What is one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years? Catherine, we'll start with you.
I'm going to go with humanness. And that is because AI is all the rage right now. We're talking about how to better integrate with AI. And it's those human skills that are going to be so important because of the new ways of working and what we've been talking about. Teams are more dynamic, more distributed. The major vehicle with which work gets done, right? But it underscores the sort of human connection within teams that leads to significantly higher productivity, the humanness.
I'll throw out the word social in the sense that most of HR is and continues to be focused on human capital, the skills, the capability, they exist as atoms in isolation a lot of times, even though we know that's not true. We know the work gets done in teams. We know that people's networks have a significant impact in all sorts of positive outcomes for them. We're still not to a point where those elements are commonly thought of and cultivated. Whether you're onboarding people, whether you're delivering well-being programs, whether you're worried about DE&I, not just as a product of do we have numbers, but are they positioned in networked well? There's a lot of things that, especially as our organizations have become more flat, one firm, interconnected, that collaborative element, that social element is really critical to begin to be analytically understanding and taking action, not just as a concept, but being really precise on the model level.
Humanness and social. Catherine, Rob, thank you for coming to share your research, the team and network effect. Great conversation. And we'll make sure that we put this in the link notes, show notes, so people can actually find the research and check it out for themselves. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of Future of HR Podcast. Thanks again to Rob and Catherine for sharing their research on the team network effect. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. We'll be back next week with Tim Richmond, CHRO for AbbVie. AbbVie is a $53 billion powerhouse in their industry, focused on discovering and delivering innovative medicines and solutions that enhance people's lives. And under Tim's leadership, AbbVie is consistently recognized as an employer of choice and was recognized on 40-plus great workplace and diversity inclusion lists in 2024 alone. In our conversation, we cover a wide range of topics from his HR leadership philosophies, how to build a culture from the ground up, and the importance of people leaders. This is a great conversation with a great CHRO and one you will not want to miss. Thanks again for listening to the Future of HR and being part of our community.